your face off good." Leah looked up at me in astonishment, and I realized that she had never been treated like this in her life. I had never been anything but quietly insistent when we discussed some issue of importance between us. Leah knew very little about the natural humiliation of being a child, and how grown people regularly trample on the feelings of the little people so helpless under their care. "Go to the living room, Leah," I said. "You look perfectly wonderful." Leah avoided meeting her grandmother's eyes as, furious, she exited the room. Yes, she's a McCall, I thought, as I watched her proud retreat. "You hurt Leah's feelings," I said. "Don't ever do it again."
"Someone needs to look out for the best interests of that child," Lucy said. "You've dressed her up like a whore."
"Mama," I said, trying to be patient, but feeling my own darkness rising within me. "Paris and Linda Shaw are throwing a party for you. He's a wonderful novelist, and she's an elegant hostess, and they live in a beautiful apartment. All of our friends in Rome will be there. They want to show me and Leah that they love us. They want to show you that they're very happy you're alive, and that you've come to visit, and that I'm getting back together with my family after years of separation. But I knew you'd find some way to ruin this evening. All during my life, you always worked hard to mess up a happy occasion. Happiness seems to enrage you. Celebration pisses you off."
"You don't know what you're talking about," Lucy said, backing away. "I've always loved parties."
"You do, and you'll have a good time at the one tonight. But you're an engineer of discord," I said. "What you just did was ruin the party for Leah, and because Leah's going to be unhappy, you just ruined it for me."
"It's not my fault if you don't understand what's appropriate for a little girl and what's not."
"I'm going to the living room, Mama," I said, and I heard the coldness in my voice. "And I'm going to tell Leah that she looks lovely and what she's wearing is fine. You just gave me a small glimpse of why I hate America and why I always felt ugly as a child."
"Your childhood was pure happiness," Lucy sneered. "You don't even know what a bad childhood looks like. And you're raising Leah to think she's the Queen of Sheba or something."
"Get control of yourself, Mother," I said. "I'm going to talk to Leah."
"You'd better back me up, Jack," Lucy whispered hotly. "Otherwise that child will have no respect for me at all."
I found Leah on the terrace, shivering in the cold and crying hard. I led her into the living room where we sat on the couch, and she, heartbroken, cried. When her sobbing began to slow down, I chose my words with great care. "Lucy was completely and totally and undeniably wrong in saying what she did, Leah," I said, hugging her to me.
"Then why did she say it?"
Leah asked, wiping her tears with her hand.
"Because she's nervous about the party," I said. "There's no one my mother's ever met that she didn't feel inferior to. It's easier to be mean to you and me than to face the fact that she's terrified to meet our friends in Rome."
"I thought I looked pretty," Leah said. I kissed her hand and said, "No one's ever looked better since the beginning of time, at least to me." Leah's composure was returning slowly.
"Should I put Mama's pearls back in her box? Well, you look perfect with them, except now your eyes are swollen and red."
"I couldn't help crying, Daddy," Leah said. "I've never had anyone talk to me like that."
"Well, she's jealous of you and all the things you have," I said. "My mother always told us that her childhood had been bad, but she wouldn't say how. I now think it was more than bad, that it was truly terrible."
"Well, if she had a bad childhood, Daddy, why would she want to hurt me?" Leah asked.
"Because when you've been hurt, you lose trust in the world," I said. "If the world's mean to you when you're a child, you spend the rest of your life being mean back."
"I don't think I like your mother, Daddy," Leah said.
I laughed. "You don't have to. You can choose to like any human being you feel like liking. That's your decision, and in that, Leah, you're a sovereign nation unto yourself. But what you don't know about my mother is coming up for your inspection."
"What do you mean, Daddy?" Leah asked.
"My mother is a great, undiscovered actress," I said, as we heard Lucy's high heels clicking rapidly down the marble hall. She made a grand entrance with a loud rattling of gold chains and bracelets. She looked at Leah and exclaimed,
"You look absolutely heavenly, darling, just ravishing, a rare statement of impeccable taste. Are those Shala's pearls? They look as beautiful on you as they did on her. Here, let me wash your lips with this cloth.
I want you to wear some of my own lipstick. It's far more chic and grown up than the kind you're wearing. I bought you a tube of your own just today." As Lucy very carefully removed the lipstick from Leah's mouth and began applying her own, she noticed that Leah had been crying. "Did your father say something to hurt your feelings?" Lucy said, turning a furious eye on me. "Men, they're not much good for anything except breaking your heart and letting out the hogs."
"Letting out the hogs?" Leah asked.
"Just an expression, honey," Lucy said happily. "Growing up in the South, I learned lots of country expressions. Now you be nice to Leah, Jack. You don't understand what a treasure you have here. And enjoy this girl while you can. You won't have her forever."
Within a few minutes, we left for the party in Trastevere, in order to arrive exactly an hour after the invitation said the party would start. Time is an elusive and foreign concept in Rome, and no Roman worth his salt or his lineage would feel anything other than keen embarrassment over arriving at a party at the suggested hour. When I first came to the city, I had arrived at 8 o'clock for dinner parties, only to find hostess after hostess in the shower. It takes a while for Americans, noted by the Romans for their hilarious punctuality, to adjust, but adjust I did. I stood by the door, introducing Lucy to my Roman friends. Lucy looked lovely and was her most charming and gracious self.
"Who's this?"
she whispered, as a handsome man with a lion-esque head stormed through the front door.
"Mother, I'd like you to meet Gore Vidal," I said. "Gore, this is my mother, the predatory Lucy McCall Pitts."
"Go on," Lucy said. "You're not Gore Vidal."
"I beg your pardon, madam," Gore said, arching his eyebrows like a misplaced king.
"Mom, don't play Eliza Doolittle with me," I said, nervous because I knew of Gore's massive contempt for his native unwashed.
"You're the writer Gore Vidal," she said. "I've read all your books."
"I rather doubt it, madam," Gore said. "I've written far too many. I've had trouble calling them all to mind myself."
"No," Lucy insisted. "At the library in Waterford, I've won the award for the citizen who reads the most books more times than anyone in the history of the town."
"Jack, this is a play and I'm being set up as a fool. Such egregious provincialism makes me long for an insulin shot."
"It's just my mother being herself," I shrugged.
"It's nice that you can visit your son, Miss Lucy," Gore said. "My mother was a perfect monster."
"I'm sure she just didn't have much to work with, Gore,"
Lucy said, and Gore bellowed with laughter and swept on into the party. My mother moved among my Roman friends for the next 2 hours, and she made her brand of southern charm seem contagious. She moved from group to group, and I could hear her accent all night, followed by the laughter and appreciation of my friends. As Leah and I made our way through the ranks of the partygoers, it seemed only minutes before the bells of Rome were warming up in a dozen belfries near us, and the soft hands of clocks were inching their way toward the midnight hour. Thanking Linda and Paris for the party, my mother paused to bid farewell to Gore Vidal, whom she had taken a shine to.
"Gore," my mother said, "come visit us in South Carolina."
"Lucy, darling," he answered, "why on earth would I do that to myself?" And both of them laughed as he kissed my mother's hand, then Leah's. Gore said, as he studied Leah's curtsy to him, "This child is lovely. She looks as though she were born in pearls."
"The pearls were my idea," Lucy said, walking out into the Roman night as Leah and I shared a look.
A cab led us off near the Tiber, and we joined that great, splendidly dressed crowd that made its way between the two encircling colonnades that led to St. Peter's. It was a slow-moving, reflective congregation, like some grazing flock of herbivores who fed on prayer and incense and unleavened bread. Being so near a church again reminded Lucy that she had cancer, and she said a rosary as we waited in the prodigious lines that formed around every entryway. In all of its exuberant excess, St. Peter's had always prompted me to remember that the simplicity of the Protestants had sprung quite naturally from the exorbitance of churches like this. Baptist friends from the South had to fight off a gag reflex when I brought them face to face with the Roman Church's inflation of taste. But I liked the excess of it all, the sumptuousness, and I tried to explain to visitors that this is what the artists of the Middle Ages thought that heaven might look like.
The incense recalled my boyhood days as an altar boy, the smell of prayer put to the torch. When we got to our places and kneeled, Leah whispered to me and said, "Grandma doesn't like it that I'm Jewish." "I don't care," I said. "Do you?" "She says it'll only confuse me spiritually." "I was raised Catholic," I whispered. "I'm totally confused spiritually." "Grandma said you don't know the first thing about raising a Jewish girl," she said. "She's right," I said. "I'm winging it, kid, doing the best I can." "I told her you were doing a great job." "Thanks, you won't later."
"Why?"
she asked. "Growing up," I explained. "In a couple of years, everything I say will strike you as silly or ridiculous. Even the sound of my voice will irritate you."
"I don't think so. Are you certain? Certo?"
she asked. "Certo," I said. "Part of natural law. I used to think everything my mother said was absolutely wonderful, and that she was the smartest person in the world."
"No," Leah said.
"Yes," I said. "Then I became a teenager and realized she was a complete idiot, and so was everyone around me."
"It must be interesting," Leah said, eyeing my mother. "This becoming a teenager."
"One finds it so," I said, as the basilica continued to fill up with the hushed, vast throngs. When I sat back, I felt a tap on my shoulder, and I heard Jordan's voice directly behind me. This surprised me, but then I remembered that it was Jordan who had gotten me tickets for the midnight mass.
"Leah's a doll baby. It's like watching Shyla," Jordan said to me.
My mother began to teach Leah to use the rosary, and both of them were concentrating on the row of white beads Leah held in her hands.
"One of the letters you brought today, Jack. My father wants to come to Rome to meet me after the New Year."
"I'm glad only if you are," I said. "Your dad's never been one of my favorites." I stood up to let some late arrivals push by me for their seats in the center of the row. Jordan said,
"You've always had this silly prejudice against sadism. What do you make of it?"
"The science project you did in high school," I said in a low voice. "The one on coral snakes? They rarely bite anyone, but the ones they do almost never survive. Your dad's like that."
"Mom claims it's a peace mission," said Jordan. "He wants to extend an olive branch."
"Or beat you to death with it," I said.
"He's coming whether I agree or not," Jordan said. "What shall I do?"
"A transfer to Patagonia?"
"Hush, son," my mother said in her most commanding voice. "The Pope's coming up the center aisle."
"Later," Jordan said, and disappeared into the Christmas night. A choir of nuns sang bird-like in a distant eyrie as the Pope moved down the main aisle, blessing all he passed. I watched as my mother received the papal blessing and took it in with the gratitude of an outfielder shagging a long fly ball. The Pope was surrounded by a whole civilization of cardinals and monsignors who escorted him with the same patience I had seen with cowbirds in the Low Country following the footsteps of a prize bull. At communion time, I followed my mother up to the rail, where we both received the Eucharist from Pope John Paul II. As we lined up with the surging crowds around us, I watched as priests appeared in every side altar, and dozens appeared at the main altar to distribute the body and blood of God in a sacrament of mass production. But my mother looked radiant and hopeful as she prayed for a long time on her knees when we returned to our seats. Looking toward the back of the church, I saw uniformed men with machine guns vigilantly appraising the crowd's behavior. The Pope looked thin and gaunt, and I remembered that he had been shot by a young Turkish assassin in the piazza outside. I felt the mask going through me, but not touching me. I was part of what was wrong with my century. Later, I would say that it was at this moment in the Vatican that I began the terrible countdown toward the unknown. In the days to come, I would try to reassemble all those random thoughts that coalesced when I looked toward the rear of St. Peter's and watched those men with their silent coverage of the Pope's flanks. I had an appointment with darkness that I was walking toward with wide-eyed innocence and a placid sense of well-being. Time itself had spotted me in an open field. I had been singled out by hooded, peregrine eyes when all I was feeling was an utter buoyancy and joy that my life was filling itself in, repairing all the cracks and damage. But first, I had to endure the terror-haunted void of forgetfulness. I had to wait for my cue, for the lights to shine on me, for my unutterable time to call out my given name as a casting call for evil itself. 2 days later, on December 27, 1985, I could feel no change in the barometric pressure as I paid the taxi driver who helped me unload the luggage at the Rome airport. As far as I could tell, no star shifted a single magnitude of candle power as Lucy, Leah, and I entered through the middle door, past the armed carabinieri, and made our way to the Pan Am check-in booth. Nothing was different on this trip than on any of the other 1,000 I had taken in a lifetime of send-offs and journeys. I do not remember handing in all the tickets and passports at the Pan Am check-in place, nor do I remember looking at my new watch to tell my mother it was 2 minutes after 9 o'clock. We had 10 pieces of luggage among us, and the ticket man and I had a brief skirmish about whether I should pay for extra baggage. Across from Pan Am, an El Al flight was taken off at the same time, and an enormous crowd jostled against each other as they moved through the security checkpoint that led to the flight gates. Above us, armed guards patrolled a steel runway with machine guns, and the bored, disinterested faces of guards were everywhere. Leah would reconstruct all of this much later. I took our boarding passes and looked over toward the gates when I saw 4 strangely dressed men walking toward us. 2 wore elegant gray suits, 2 were dressed in blue jeans, and all wore scarves that partially concealed their faces. The men began opening duffel bags they carried, and one of them pulled the pin of a grenade and tossed it. Then all 4 men pulled out machine guns, and in a blind, heedless fury, turned their deadly fire on those in the 820-foot-long terminal. I reached for Leah and threw her over the ticket counter on top of the man who just issued our boarding passes. "Stay down, Leah," I screamed, and I then moved toward my frightened, disoriented mother, who had drifted out toward the center as El Al guards began returning a murderous fire, and Italian guards closed in fast on the 4 Palestinian terrorists, who were there to kill as many people as possible before being cut down themselves. Lucy was standing straight up, open-mouthed, when I reached her and tackled her and lay my body on top of hers. It was then that I felt 2 bullets from an AK-47 automatic rifle, 1 to my head and 1 to my shoulder. I heard my mother scream once, then I was overwhelmed by the pandemonium of gunfire and grenades exploding near us, and the screaming of those unharmed but paralyzed with terror. "Are you okay, Mama? You okay?" I asked, as I watched blood spotting her winter coat. Then I lost consciousness. A man and a woman lying beside us were dead. What I tell you next, I learned later. When the shooting stopped, 16 people lay dead and 74 wounded, and the airport looked like a sheep's abattoir. Leah rushed from body to body in a desperate search for her father and grandmother. My great weight had pinned my mother to the floor, and Leah had to enlist the aid of an El Al attendant to roll me off her. I would not regain consciousness for 3 days. Blood covered my head and eyes, and Leah began screaming when she thought I had died. But this would be the day she would learn about the strength of grandmothers. "Jack's still breathing. He's alive. Let's make sure we get him on one of those first ambulances. We're going to need your Italian, darling," my mother said. Leah and Lucy raced toward the main door as the sounds of ambulances lifted all over Rome, and they streaked, along with camera crews and journalists, toward Fiumicino. When the first ambulance team burst into the stricken airport, Leah began screaming, mio papà, non è morto, sangue, signore, il sangue è terribile, per favore, mio papà, signori." The 2 men followed the pretty young child they thought was Italian, and I was the first one taken out of the airport and into an ambulance, and the first victim to appear on Italian television as a camera crew began filming. My head and upper torso were covered in blood, and Lucy's winter coat looked like it had been dipped in the blood of her son as she held on to me. It was an image that was being broadcast all over Italy. At that very moment, Jordan Elliott was coming out of the class he taught on the limits of dogma at the North American College near the Trevi Fountain. As he entered the teacher's lounge, he saw a cluster of his brother priests huddled around a television set. "There's been a massacre at the Rome airport," Father Regis, a Latin scholar, said. "It looks very bad." "They're bringing someone out now," another voice said. Jordan did not recognize me because of the blood, but he cried out when he saw Leah and Lucy hurrying to keep pace with the stretcher-bearers. In a daze, he heard the announcer report the location of the hospital near the Vatican, where surgeons were already gathering from all over Rome to receive the wounded. Jordan sprinted out of the room, without explanation, in a headlong dash to a taxi stand. He had been right halfback in the same backfield at Waterford High, where I had played fullback. Mike Hess had been the left half, and Capers Middleton had called signals at quarterback. It was well known around the state in 1965 as the Middleton backfield, and when the team needed short yardage, they went to their huge, pug-nosed fullback, me. But when they needed the long yardage, they went to their big playback, the one who could turn it upfield, the guy who ran the 110 flat, the swift and elusive Jordan Elliott. No Roman who passed Jordan as he raced toward the taxi stand in the Piazza Venezia ever forgot the speed of that priest, or at least that is what he told me. When he reached the first waiting taxi, he jumped in the front seat screaming, "Al pronto soccorso, all'ospedale, al pronto soccorso." When they unloaded me at Santo Spirito Hospital, Jordan was waiting for us. "Go to the waiting room, Leah and Lucy," he commanded. "I'll meet you down there later. Trust in the Lord." As the stretcher-bearers began their long run toward the clear hallways, Father Jordan ran beside me, making the sign of the cross and giving me the short form of absolution, used only in cases of extraordinary urgency. He said it in Latin because he knew I was one of those irritating, fallen-away Catholics who retained a strong nostalgia for the Latin service. "Ego te absolvo ab omnibus censuris et peccatis, in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen." This performance of extreme unction led off the evening news in Italy. As Jordan began making the sign of the cross over my two grievous wounds, he said while holding one of my hands, "If you are sorry for all your sins, please squeeze my hand if you can hear me, Jack." "There was a small pressure from me," he said later, and Jordan went on, "You are absolved of all your sins, Jack. Go into this operation with no fear for your soul. But remember who you are, Jack. You're Jack McCall from Waterford, South Carolina, the strongest man or boy I ever knew. Use that strength now, Jack. Use every ounce of it. Fight this thing with everything you've got. Leah, your mom and I are waiting for you. Use your strength for us. Fight this one for us, the ones that love you, need you." The door burst open into the brightly lit operating room, but before they took me away, he said, I squeezed his hand one more time, and this time harder. "Into God's hands I commend you, Jack McCall," said Jordan, making a final sign of the cross at the door where the surgeons began to work on the two bullet wounds. Much later, when I began to piece together the fragments of any memory I had of the incident, I remembered some of the wild ride from the airport into Rome. Leah was crying and saying, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy," over and over again, and I tried to reach out for her, but a sleeping numbness spread through me like a drug, and there was silence and darkness again. The next thing I remember is the ambulance driver taking a corner fast, and Lucy shouting to the driver, "Slow down!" And the heartbreaking sound again of Leah crying and my frustration at not being able to comfort her. I was in the operating room for 6 hours. The surgeons managed to save my left eye. The bullet had entered my shoulder, lodged near the lung, and that was the bullet that almost killed me. I had already bled profusely when I reached the operating room table, and my heart stopped twice during the course of the operation. But the strength that Jordan talked about prevailed, and I, because of fate and luck, and perhaps because of the prayers of those who loved me, survived the airport massacre in Rome. For 6 days, mirroring my mother's own recent stillness, I lay in a coma. Later, I could resurrect no dreams from that period of dormancy and stillness. Though I had some sense that it had been a time of vivid, transfiguring dreaming, nothing of it remained that I could hold on to, except a phantasmagoria of bright colors. The assault of colors was the only thing I brought back from my voyage in timelessness, as my body concentrated on its task of survival. Finally, I awoke slowly to bells. It was as though I was rising like a bird from a cavern in the center of the earth. I could feel that thing called self reconstructing in my bloodstream while I formed my first conscious thought since being wounded. I listened to the Eternal City call out my name. For an hour, I listened and wondered where I was and why I could not see. But this was all done calmly and without panic. Then I heard voices talking quietly in the room around me. I concentrated hard on recognizing the voices, but they were low-pitched, so as not to bother or awaken me. Then I heard one voice, and that voice made me struggle to recover my own from wherever it had gone to hide. For another hour, I concentrated on coming to the surface, coming out to the light, to the world of bells and voices, to that world abandoned where I could laugh and talk. For a long time, I thought about the first word I would say, and struggled fiercely to say it in my blindness and in the pain I was beginning to feel for the first time. Finally, I heard the word forming like a gemstone in my chest.
Leah.
Daddy! I heard Leah scream back. Then I felt my child kissing the side of my face that was not covered with bandages.
Daddy, thank God, Daddy, thank God, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy,
Leah said over and over again.
I was so afraid you were going to die, Daddy.
No such luck, I said slowly, and the full measure of my disorientation was becoming clear to me.
Hello, Jack, Lucy said to me. Welcome back. You've been gone a long time.
Did we catch that plane? I asked, and the whole room exploded into laughter.
Don't you remember, Daddy? Leah said.
Help me, I said. First, why can't I see any of you?
Your eyes are bandaged, Lucy said.
Am I blind? I asked.
You almost were, my mother said.
Nice word, almost, I said. I feel like I've been run over by a rhinoceros.
You were shot twice, a third voice said.
Who else is here? Ladere, is that you? I said, lifting an arm up toward her.
Ladere took my hand and sat beside me. Hey, Jack, I came as soon as I heard.
Ladere, that's so nice, I said.
Leah hasn't left your side once, Ladere said. Your mother and I have taken turns going to your apartment to get some rest and clean up. Leah's been here the whole time. What an extraordinary child you've raised, Jack.
With those words of praise, Leah broke down and wept as hard as it was possible for a child to weep. Ladere moved off the bed, and Leah crawled up against me. She cried for 10 minutes, and I let her cry and did nothing to stop it, but pressed her tightly to me. I let the sobs run down and the tears dry, and I did not speak until she lay silent beside me.
"Want me to tell you a story?" I asked.
"Yes, Daddy, tell me a great story," Leah said, exhausted.
"I only know one great subject," I said.
"The great dog Chippy," Leah said, brightening. "Did you know the great dog Chippy, Ladere?"
"Yes," Ladere laughed. "I knew Chippy."
"She was a mutt, for God's sake," Lucy said. But I pointed a warning finger at her.
"I want to hear a great dog Chippy story, Daddy," Leah said.
"Well, you've got to pick the subject," I said.
"Okay," Leah said,
and she grew curiously quiet and thoughtful. Then she said,
"I know the story I want to hear."
"You've got to tell me," I said, puzzled.
"You may not want to tell it, Daddy," Leah said.
"I'll tell anything," I said. "It's only a story."
Leah began crying again, then got control of herself and said,
"I want to hear about the great dog Chippy and the Rome airport."
"That's the silliest thing I've ever heard of," Lucy said.
But Leah was crying again, and I said, "No, Mama, I know what Leah's after."
"I just think it's nonsense to dredge up bad memories," Lucy said. "We've all been through enough. I'm so upset I forgot I had leukemia with the commotion and all."
"Listen, Lucy," I heard Ladere say as I began my story.
On December 27th, 1985, Jack McCall and his lovely daughter Leah were packing for their trip to South Carolina. Jack's wicked mother, Lucy, was bawling out the maid, Maria, in English, even though Maria only could speak Italian.
"I resent that," Lucy muttered.
"It's only a story, Mama,"
I said, then continued. All of Leah's friends from school had come to wish her a buon viaggio, and they lined up along the piazza, singing to Leah as her taxi pulled away into the Rome traffic. I heard something I hadn't heard for years. It was a familiar bark, and I looked behind me and saw a small black dog with a white cross on its throat running after the cab.
"It's the great dog Chippy," Leah said.
I thought Chippy was dead because she'd disappeared years before in Waterford, and my mother, the evil-hearted Lucy, told me that Chippy had gone off in the woods to die.
"I used to have to feed that dumb dog," Lucy protested.
"Every story needs a villain," I explained.
"Believe me," Lucy said, "this story's going to have some."
I told the cab driver to stop and then opened the back door. The great dog Chippy jumped into the back of the cab and licked me on the face for a full 5 minutes. Then I introduced the great dog Chippy to the great girl Leah, and Chippy licked her face for the next 5 minutes. Then Chippy saw Lucy, and the hair on the back of her spine bristled, and the great dog went, "Grrr."
"I'll admit that ratty dog didn't like me," Lucy said, "but she sure warmed up to me at mealtime."
"Why didn't she like you, Grandma?" Leah asked.
"I used to whop her on the butt with a broom when I caught her sleeping on the couch," said Lucy. "Of course, that was about 5 times a day. You couldn't teach that dog doodly."
The great dog Chippy was too busy performing heroic acts to learn silly animal tricks. So Chippy rode with us all the way to the Rome airport, and I made plans to buy a special cage so that we could bring the great dog Chippy back to South Carolina with us. The taxi pulled up to the main entrance, and Leah, the great dog Chippy, and the wicked Lucy walked happily with me into the terminal. The first person they saw was Natasha Jones with her wonderful white dog, Bianco. Leah went over to introduce the great dog Chippy to Bianco, and it was decided that the two dogs would share the same cage for the trip back to the States. I sensed the room tense, and I didn't know why until I heard Ladere say,
"Natasha Jones was killed during the massacre, Jack. Her father and brother were wounded."
"Jesus Christ," I said. "I don't even remember seeing Natasha and her parents that day."
"I didn't go to her funeral because I wanted to be with you, Daddy," Leah said, her voice fragile.
"You did right, Leah," I said. "I needed you more than Natasha did. Could someone tell me what happened? I'm going to need some help if I'm going to finish this great dog Chippy story. I don't remember another thing, nothing."
Ladere began talking because she saw that neither Lucy nor Leah could speak.
4 gunmen entered the airport with their weapons concealed. They carried 13 hand grenades and 4 AK-47 automatic rifles. You were at the ticket counter when the shooting broke out," Ladere continued. "You picked Leah up and threw her behind the counter, where she lay flat on the ground until the shooting stopped. Then you ran and knocked your mother to the ground and shielded her from the bullets. That's when you were hit, once in the head, just above the left eye. The bullet missed the brain by a centimeter. Once in the shoulder that lodged in your chest, piercing the left lung."
"I don't remember a single thing that happened," I said.
"A man in Malaga, Spain, called up a radio station and took credit for the airport attacks for the Abu Nidal group and the PLO. There was another massacre in Vienna at the same time. Can you imagine the nerve?" Lucy said.
"Long live Israel," I said. "Okay, let's get back to the story." As Chippy was getting to know Bianco, the great dog's eye started roving around the airport. Chippy had an amazing ability to judge people's characters just by looking at them. It was an instinct that Chippy was born with. Just like bird dogs have an incredible sense of smell, Chippy had a great sense of sniffing out good from evil. She looked around and saw happy people getting ready to take wonderful trips, until her eyes rested on 4 men she didn't like. In fact, we can be brutally honest and say the great dog Chippy didn't like these 4 losers at all.
"Uh-oh," Leah said. "Those 4 guys are going to get it now."
The great dog Chippy walked over to take a peek at what was going on. The nearer she got to those 4, the more cunning and wolf-like the great dog Chippy became. In fact, she seemed to grow stockier and more muscular, and her fangs sharpened as she caught a scent of evil like she'd never smelled before. She leapt up on the counter of the bar and moved like a great cat, stepping gingerly over coffee cups so that she didn't spill anybody's cappuccino. By the time she reached the end of that counter, the great dog Chippy had transformed herself into a dog of war, a dog of blood. The city where a wolf had once suckled Romulus and Remus had need of wolves again, fiercer and more bloodthirsty than the one who had mothered Rome's founders. Rome called for a wolf.
"And the great dog Chippy answered," Leah cried out.
"The great dog Chippy answered, all right," I said. The four men began to take out their AK-47s and their hand grenades. Then they turned toward a crowd of people who had gathered at the Pan Am and El Al ticket counters. One of them pointed at sweet and wonderful Natasha Jones, and another man pointed his rifle at the delightful and beautiful Leah McCall. And just before they began firing, the four men heard something that froze the roots of their souls with fear.
"Grr!" Leah snarled fiercely.
"Grr!" I snarled along with her. "They had forgotten about one thing," I said.
Leah said, "They'd forgotten about the great dog Chippy."
The great dog went for the first terrorist's throat, and her fangs severed the carotid artery as they tore through the neck of a man who'd never hurt anyone else again. His rifle went off, harmlessly spraying bullets into the ceiling. The second terrorist shot at the great dog Chippy, but that dog had already sunk her fangs into that man's genitalia, and the scream from that man brought security police running from everywhere. Then Chippy whirled and ran through a hail of bullets as the remaining two men standing knew who their true enemy was now. The great dog Chippy was hit by one of the bullets, but one bullet isn't enough to stop the great dog Chippy.
"No way," Leah said happily. "One bullet's nothing to the great dog Chippy."
"I sure as hell didn't see that damn dog," Lucy said.
The third man had a knife scar that went the length of his face. The great dog Chippy went for that scar. Her fangs ripped into the man's face, and as the man hit the ground, the dog leapt toward the throat of the last man standing. The last man stood his ground and fired all his bullets into the great dog Chippy. Chippy, the great dog, staggered toward the last man, but did not have the strength to make it. She turned to Jack and Leah and Lucy and gave them a last, affectionate bark of farewell. Then the great dog Chippy put her head between her paws and died a sweet and peaceful death. An El Al security guard shot the man who killed the great dog Chippy and killed him on the spot.
"No, Daddy," Leah said. "The great dog Chippy can't die. It's not fair."
"Chippy died when I was 18, sweetheart," I said. "Because your mama died, I never wanted to tell you that Chippy died, too."
"Chippy's grave is in the backyard," Lucy said. "It's kind of pretty. Jack made the tombstone himself."
"I've been waiting for that story since you were hurt, Daddy," Leah said. "I wish it were true."
"Stories don't have to be true. They just have to help," I said.
"Now, darling, I'm exhausted."
"Let him get some rest, Leah," Lucy said. "I'll take you home and feed you."
"I'm staying here," Leah said.
"You'll do what I say, young lady," Lucy insisted, and I could hear the fear and relief in my mother's voice.
"Leah and I are a team, Mama," I said. "Let her be."
"Are we still going back to Waterford when you get well?" Leah asked.
"Yeah, kid, I didn't do this right. You don't know any of the stories that made you who you are."
"The movie's on, Jack," Ladea said. "Mike sent me the first check when he heard you were shot. You're hired whether you want to be or not."
"Some of the stories Mike wants," I said, "are the ones I need to tell Leah."
"You tell the ones you know," Ladea said. "I'll fill in where I can."
"Ladea," I asked, "did you come here because of the movie?"
"Sorry to disappoint you," Ladea answered. "I came because you needed me."
"You're welcome to Italy and everything in it," my mother said. "I'll be getting back to Waterford day after tomorrow. Need to get out of this crazy country. Course I'm going to hire an armored car to ride to the airport. I won't feel safe again till I smell collard greens cooking."
"We'll follow you when we can, Mama," I said.
"Jordan was on television," Ledea said, "giving you the last rites. Mike has the tapes. So does General Elliot."
The plot thickens.
"Why is Jordan hiding, Daddy?" Leah said. "He's been here to the hospital a bunch of times, but always in the middle of the night."
As I tried to answer, I felt myself falling away from all of them, and sleep felt like a black hole where all time fell in an endless cascade that began with lost words at the touch of Leah's hand against mine, and ended in a sleep too soon in the coming. Chapter 19. I left the hospital days later with a plum-tinged wound of entry that Leah touched tenderly as my bandages were removed for the last time. Dr. Guido Guccioli, who had saved my sight, gave me last pointers about the necessity of resting my eyes and the dangers of strain. He explained how the rods and cones clustered like colorless grapes along retinal nerves, and how the operation he performed was much like tuning a piano the size of a quail's egg. The doctor and three of the nurses came down into the street as Ledea and Leah helped me into the taxi that would take me home.
"Hey, Guido, can I French kiss you?" I asked.
"No, of course not. It would be undignified and unsanitary," the doctor said as he kissed me on both cheeks. "But with Signora Ledea it would be a different story."
On the taxi ride home, I rolled the window down and let the soft, pillowed air flow over and through me. It was smooth as new linen across my face. Even the Tiber smelled rich and dark when we passed above it, as it divided itself into two congruent fragments of river and embraced the sharp prow of the Isola Tiberina. In the Piazza Farnese, a small group from the neighborhood had gathered outside of my building. Maria, her fingers entwined with her rosary, was there, as were a few neighbors. Two nuns wearing gardening gloves emerged from their jewel-box cloister. The Ruggeri brothers ran over from the Alimentari, their hands smelling of cheese. There was Freddy in his white waiter's coat, the olive man, and two of the fruit ladies from the Campo, the chicken and egg lady, the beautiful blonde from the office supply store, Eduardo, the master of coffee and cornetti, Aldo, the newsman, and the owner of the piazza's single restaurant. A small cheer went up among the assembled friends when I emerged from the taxi and made my way unsteadily toward the front door. Because of my being wounded, the massacre had touched this piazza in a direct and personal way. The merchants sent over fruit and vegetables from the Campo dei Fiori and would not take Ledea's money during the first week of my return. The fishwives sent up mussels and cod. The chicken man brought up freshly killed hens. My generous neighbors took care of everything during the first weeks of my convalescence at home. Each day I walked among them through the narrow streets, building my strength. Though I have traveled on almost every continent and spent time among scores of nationalities, I have never quite fathomed or understood the gruffness and originality that Romans bring to tenderness. Their instinct for the small gestures of friendship is unerring. The proficiency they bring to the task of embracing the acceptable stranger is a form of municipal cunning. My neighbors welcomed me back to the piazza and rejoiced in my recovery. Romans, Romans, I thought. They cannot crook their little fingers without teaching the rest of the world inimitable lessons about pageantry and hospitality. Watching my return, I later learned, through a pair of high-powered Nikon binoculars, was Jordan Elliott, clean-shaven and dressed in jeans, worker boots, and a well-cut Armani dress shirt. He watched as Ledea and I entered the building, me leaning more on her than on the tubular, rubber-tipped walking cane they had given me at the hospital. The bureaucratic process for checking out of the hospital had just about finished me, and the emotional homecoming so touched me that it took away the last bit of strength I could muster. The portiere held the door as though a prince were returning, and I smiled my thanks to him. A photographer from Il Messaggero captured the authentic note of cordiality and nostalgia in the homecoming. The flower ladies presented bouquets of anemones and zinnias into Leah's arms. But there was little sentimentality in Jordan's surveillance of the scene.
His binoculars were trained on the crowd, not on me, as I disappeared into my apartment building, its huge black doors closing behind me like the wings of an archangel. Only when the crowd broke up did Jordan isolate the object of his patient oversight. The man was trim and soldierly and barren, and Jordan figured that he must have watched my return from the safety of the simple café on the piazza, and emerged only when the crowd had begun its wordy dispersal. When he reached the fountain nearest my apartment, Jordan shivered as he reflected how odd it was to be studying in all the intimacy of magnification the robust figure of his own father. General Elliot moved with an infantryman's attention and grace, studying each face as it passed by him. He was clearly looking for Jordan, and Jordan could imagine his father's impatience as he failed to see him in the crowd. Soon after I had been brought to the hospital, Jordan had appeared on television sets all over the nation as the ambulance doors opened and I was wheeled into the emergency room. As a Trappist priest who had spent much of his adult life in a monastery, the one thing Jordan little understood was the power and rapidity of modern communication. The expression of grief and horror on Jordan's face when he caught sight of me became famous the moment it was flashed by satellite into all the newsrooms of the world. As he took my hand and leaned down to whisper the words of the last rites in my ear while I was wheeled from a ramp down the corridors of the alerted hospital, the lines of worry and compassion on his angular face came to define the dynamic, rugged symmetry of Italy's own communal agony. His face became famous on the peninsula within a 24-hour period. By accident, the conferral of Jordan's anguish became an eloquent gift to Italy. His face expressed everything that Italy felt about the slaughter of the holiday travelers. Italian journalists began to search for the mysterious priest. But Jordan sank back into the hidden depths of the priest-haunted city as photographs of him began to appear on the front pages of American newspapers. On the Isle of Orion, General Elliot recognized his son immediately. When the same tape rolled again 15 minutes later on CNN, he copied it so he could return to it at his leisure. General Elliot's face was unreadable, but his son's face had always been a book open for all the world's inspection. The well-trimmed beard hid the dimple he had inherited from his mother, but the handiwork of 15 years had not changed his son's face, only deepened it, made it more recognizable. Jordan's eyes were unforgettable, and his father had certainly not forgotten. He told his wife Celestine nothing, and she did not hear about my misfortune until late the next day. By then, as we later learned, the general had already gotten in touch with Mike Hess and Capers Middleton. That night, they all compared the photographs of the priest coming out of the confessional on the Aventine Hill with the priest who met my ambulance at the hospital in Trastevere. In a secret phone conference the next day, all agreed they had found their man. His being captured by the camera's eye for just that split second had brought on a wave of visitors Jordan never would have wanted, but immediately after, Jordan vanished into the terracotta silences of monastic Rome. Before the surgeons had returned me to my hospital room, Jordan had moved from an obscure monastery located in one of the more uncelebrated abbeys in the Celian Hill to a halfway house in Trastevere that cared for priests who had problems with drug addiction. A barber had shaved his beard, and he was issued a pair of tortoiseshell glasses. An underground machine had gone into operation as soon as Interpol in Rome headquarters had received a photograph of young Jordan Elliot and myself after a baseball game our senior year in high school. It was accompanied by a blow-up of the photograph of Jordan looking tenderly down at my body as it was being wheeled hastily up the emergency ramp. A fingerprinter's assistant at Interpol had copied the information and sent it to her brother, who worked for a Monsignor who oversaw a committee to reform the system of accounting at the Vatican Bank. Jordan Elliot was wanted for questioning in the death of a young Marine corporal and his girlfriend that had taken place in 1971. The bulletin indicated that Jordan might have changed his name and was believed to be masquerading as a Catholic priest of an unknown order. Jordan Elliot was described as being very intelligent, physically powerful, and perhaps armed as well.
General Elliot had secretly notified Naval Intelligence, who got in touch with their connections in Interpol and Italy. This was the first time since he had escaped to Europe that Jordan knew for sure that he was a hunted man. Though he had long suspected it, he had withdrawn from his life in South Carolina with such finality, there had even been a funeral service, that he thought any pursuit of him had long since miscarried through lack of evidence or a fresh trail. Only his mother and I were partners in his conspiracy. Jordan had lulled himself into a feeling of invisibility, and now, as he watched his father, he realized that his concern for me had put both of us in a dangerous situation. The general positioned himself in the shadows of the fountain's splashing sarcophagus, made of Egyptian granite, surrounded by illegally parked cars. He was still uncommonly handsome, Jordan thought, as he studied his father's regular features with his weather-beaten golfer's face and tanned, muscled arms. Jordan also noticed the first signs of wattles erupting beneath his father's chin. He doubted his son had ever feared a father as Jordan had feared his, and the word father, so sacred and primal in world religions, so central to the harmonic mystery of Catholicism, had always sent a shivering down his spine. It came to Jordan not as a two-syllable sound of a sweet-breathed, comfortable man armed only with rattles and lullabies, but as an army in the field with blood on its hands. Father. Jordan said the word out loud. Your father is home. Your father is home. Your father's home. The four most feared words of his boyhood coming from his sweet-lipped mother's mouth. Jordan's fear and hatred of his father had always been the purest and most unclassifiable thing about him. The power of that hatred had shaken the composure of every confessor that Jordan had gone to for the forgiveness of his sins in his career as a priest. His abbot had told him as recently as a year ago that the kingdom of heaven would be denied to him if he could not find it in his heart to forgive his father. As he studied his father, he realized that he was no nearer to the heavenly kingdom than he had been as a 10-year-old boy, weeping after still another beating, and dreaming of the day he would kill his father with his bare hands. His mother had written to Jordan. His father wanted a reconciliation. And Jordan was preparing for that rendezvous when his youthful photograph arrived in the Rome offices of Interpol and made its secret way through the labyrinthine alleyways and courtyards of the Vatican to his abbot's small office. Jordan thought his father had betrayed him, but he also thought it was possible that Capers Middleton had sold out his old friend as a dramatic set piece for his governor's campaign in South Carolina. His abbot agreed. The abbot possessed an Italian's scrupulous mistrust of politicians, and also a sweet but starchy sentimentality about fatherhood. A few days after I returned home, Maria answered the doorbell and escorted Mike and Capers into the living room where I was with Ladere. Mike's impatience was a palpable force in the room, and he paced beside the windows, a motor on overdrive somewhere in his central nervous system. But Capers was unflappable and controlled, and seemed interested in taking a careful inventory of all my antiques and paintings. As his eyes wandered among my possessions, he said, "You have nice things. What a surprise, Jack." "Take a quick inventory, then get the hell out of my house," I said. Mike interrupted quickly. "This is a business call about our movie. You don't have to fall in love with Capers, just listen to him." "I don't like Capers," I said. "I tried to make that clear in Waterford." "You were clear but wrong," Mike said. "Mike," Ladea said, "you shouldn't have done this to either one of us." "You're under contract, darling," Mike said. "I'm not required to run things by you. Ask the Writers Guild." "Capers is a lit match with us," Ladea said to Mike. "We're the gasoline. You know it well." "We both wanted to see if Jack's all right. We were worried," Mike said. "I've been praying for you," Capers said at last. "Mike," I said, "there's a Bible on my night table. Turn to the New Testament and start reading the story about Judas Iscariot. Capers will find it eerily autobiographical." "The cat's never at a loss for words," Mike said in admiration. "Old Jack," Capers said, "always comparing himself to Jesus." "Only when I'm with the man who once crucified me and all my friends," I said, feeling cold and angry.
Normally, I model myself after Julia Child.
Your shooting was headline news in South Carolina, Capers said, his voice even and eerily controlled. As soon as I heard, I made plans to fly to Rome to visit you in the hospital. In fact, there'll be an article about our visit in the state newspaper next Sunday.
Accompanied by photographs, I guessed.
How much will it cost me? Said Capers.
More than you've got, I said.
You didn't find Jordan, Ladere said. That's why you're here.
We didn't even get corroboration that Jordan Elliott's alive, Capers said. We tried the Franciscans, the Jesuits, the Paulists, the Trappists, the Benedictines. I had the help of the Bishop of Charleston. Mike was in constant contact with the Cardinal of Los Angeles. Something has gone wrong, and the whole system has shut down on us. We circulated all the photographs taken by the detective. Not one Franciscan in this city can make a positive identification of this bearded American priest. Every Franciscan we talked to was sure this man was not a member of their order. Yet he wears their habit, and he heard confessions in one of their most important churches.
Tell Jack the weird part, Mike said.
I was getting to that, Capers said. We got an interview with the head honcho of the Franciscans, the main man. The guy was a born leader, carried himself like a prince. He gives us some of the same old, looks at the photographs, never seen the guy. But then he said something interesting. He told us point blank that the Franciscans as an order, and this abbot in particular, don't take kindly to pressure from Americans, trying to track down a member of their or any other order wanted for war crimes in America. Then he asked us to leave his office.
But Jack, Capers continued, leaning forward,
we never told anyone about any war crimes. We were just looking for Jordan. We never told anyone why.
So what? I said. You think the Franciscans aren't going to do some checking on their own? They've been around since the 13th century.
Did you tip Jordan off? Capers asked.
Listen good, Capers, I don't want to have to go over this again. I was in the hospital with all the lights out, I said. But I would have warned him if I'd known you two were coming. I'd have suggested he do exactly what he's done, go underground until you guys go away.
If there's no Jordan, there's no television deal, Mike said. There's no movie.
Ladere looked at Mike.
Why would Jack care about that?
Because if there's no movie, there's no presidential pardon for Jordan Elliott, Mike said. This is all part of a big plan, Jack.
I see, Ladere said. The miniseries ends with Capers Middleton getting a presidential pardon for his old friend, Jordan Elliott. Then at the governor's inauguration in Columbia, the Middleton backfield will be united at last, a symbol of Governor Middleton's ability to handle the wounds that have torn his generation asunder.
No, baby, fine as far as it goes, Mike said, but take it further. Take it 6 years down the road at the Republican National Convention. Or wait a full 10 when Capers drops his hat in the ring for President of the United States.
Be still, my passport, I said, shaking my head sadly. If I truly loved my country, I'd throw you right out that open window, Capers, and let you free fall 5 stories to the piazza below. But alas, my patriotism is all talk.
Whoever your opponent is, Ladere said, I'll write speeches for him. I'll work for free and grant interviews to every tabloid in the country. I'll give them the names and measurements of every bimbo you slept with during our hellish years of marriage.
You won't do anything because of the kids, Capers said matter-of-factly.
They'll be old enough then, and I won't care what they think.
Your weakness, dear, is that you'll always care too much what they think, said Capers, going in for the kill. You're very much aware that Mother's Day is not at the top of their list of favorite holidays.
Let's cut to the chase, Mike said. Are you going to help us find Jordan or not, Jack? You signed a contract, too.
Cup your hand to your ear, Mike, I said. Please listen to me this time. We've already had one painful meeting about this, and I don't look forward to another. I won't help you at all because I hate your buddy Capers. Is that clear enough?
You describe your feelings toward me as hatred, Capers asked.
Yes, I said. That would eloquently sum it all up.
Is there nothing I can do to change the way you feel? Capers asked.
I'm afraid not, Capers. Sorry, old chum.
Let me level with you, Jack, Mike said,
looking at Capers, who nodded at him. "The movie needs Jordan because none of us know his whole story. He's the key to it all. I need to sign him up, or I don't think I can sell it to one of the networks. Got it? That's my professional interest. Now, Capers. The Democrats are going to try to highlight what Capers did to his friends in college. They've collected photographs of Capers surfing with Jordan, and of all of us triumphant after we won the state championship in football. Get the picture? I've seen the ads they're writing up. The stuff is catastrophic."
"So this has nothing to do with friendships or nostalgia or simple regret," I said.
"Nothing," Ladere answered. "It has only to do with Capers' favorite topic, Capers Middleton."
"You're not as pretty when you're cynical," Capers said.
"But I'm a lot smarter, aren't I?" she shot back.
"It's a mean world and you're a part of it, isn't it, Capers?" I said.
Capers answered,
"It's mean for all of us. Style is what we mean by how we manage it."
"Style you know about," said Ladere, "but, darling, substance is where you draw blank."
"Tell Jordan we'd like to meet with him," Mike said. "We're in contact with his father. We've got a win-win proposition for him."
"I get it," I said. "Capers is the hero of our movie."
Capers said, rising to leave, "I've always been the hero, Jack. You had a minor role from the beginning, the sidekick, the chum, the good buddy."
"Be nice to the writers, Capers," Ladere said, "before we put you in high heels."
"That's why I got to the producer first," Capers said.
"Funny line, Ladere, but don't you dare tell me how to walk the waterfront. We're at the Hassler."
After they had left, I slept for a while, and when I awakened, the night had turned cold, and there was a blue, dewy texture to the darkness. The wind that rushed off the Tiber brought a smell of leaves and paper. Pages of Il Messaggero, with its day-old news, scudded across the piazza like clothes blown off a line. I walked to the far window of the apartment, checked the clock again, and saw that it was 9 p.m. on the nose. Turning on a light in a little-used hallway behind me, I stood centered in the frame of a huge rectangular window, and I could see the graceful dome of St. Peter's light up the modest Roman skyline. Then I saw a light wink on and off in the darkness. "Hello," the light said in Morse code. I waved and asked Ladere to come join me by the window. I pointed toward the bell tower of St. Thomas of Canterbury, and she saw a column of light winking on and off.
"That's Jordan," I said. "That's how we have to communicate."
"What does he want?" she asked.
A lingering flash of light shot toward us, followed by a short flicker, then another long beam of light, followed by darkness.
"Kilo in Morse code. It means I want to meet with you."
"How will you know where to meet?"
I scratched the back of my head, the signal that I had received the message. Three short beams of light were followed by three long ones. Then the same exact message was sent several moments later.
"Number 33, Ladere," I said. "Get the blue guide to Rome and its environs. It's on the table there. Turn to the index, page 399. There's a list of churches in the far right-hand column, starting with Sant'Adriano. That is church number 1. Count to 33 for me."
"The 33rd church listed is St. Cecilia in Trastevere," said Ladere.
"Good," I said. "That's a big church."
I scratched my head again, and there was a final flash of light.
"Jordan says good night. We meet 2 days from now in Trastevere."
"Is that where he lives?"
"I don't think so," I said, "although I have no idea where he lives. He thinks it's safer for me to know as little about his life as possible."
Ladere, looking down toward the wind-swept piazza at one lone man crossing it swiftly, said,
"Do you think Jordan's lonely, Jack?"
"I think loneliness is the central fact of his life," I said. We took a long taxi ride through the winding alleyways of Rome, and once we were sure we were not being followed, I told the driver to take us to the restaurant Galeazzi in Trastevere. We got out of the cab quickly and walked toward the huge, brooding presence of the Church of Santa Cecilia. I walked Ladere to the right side of the church beneath a painting of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary on the ceiling above us. We crossed the ancient, paved floor toward a bank of confessionals that stood in a soldierly file on the opposite end of the church. Two of the confessionals had lights on,
indicating the presence of a confessor within, but only one bore a discreet sign marked English. Motioning for Ladea to wait for me in a pew, I entered one side of the confessional and drew the curtain. Out of habit, I opened the curtain slightly to see if someone had followed us to Trastevere. I heard Jordan's muffled voice rendering absolution in flawless Italian to an elderly Roman woman whose deafness made her confession an open book to anyone within shouting distance. The panel slid, and I saw the shrouded profile of Jordan through the screen that separated confessor from sinner.
"Hey, Jordan," I said.
"Hey, big fella," Jordan said. "I'm glad to know you're all right."
He then told me that his superiors had been questioned by representatives of Interpol regarding a fugitive priest wanted for questioning about a crime that took place in 1971. The report could have come from several places, but the two most likely are my father or Capers Middleton.
"Your mother'd kill your father," I said, "and Capers practically convinced me that he needs you worse than you need him."
"Trusting Capers presents a small dilemma," Jordan said crisply.
"Where else could this have come from?" I asked.
"Mike could have told friends in Hollywood about his hiring the private investigator. Your mother could have told members of your family. My father could easily have confided in some of his oldest friends. There are a million scenarios."
"What now?"
"My abbot wants me to go away from Rome for a while," Jordan said, "until the weather clears."
"Will you tell me where you're going?" I asked.
"No, you know I can't do that, Jack," Jordan said. "But I'd like you to do me a favor. I'd like you to set up a meeting for me with my father, but use extreme caution. Be very careful."
"I will," I said. "Ladere is with me, and she could help."
"Good. Ask her to come to the other side of the confessional, and let's plan how the meeting with my father should take place."
"When are you going to see your mother?" I asked.
"I already have. She understands why I need to see him. I've always wanted to have a father, Jack. You know that. I've never had one in my life."
"You overrate it," I said.
"No," he said. "I just need one."
Chapter 20. 2 days later, I awaited the arrival of General Elliot in the bar of the Hotel Raphael. When he finally appeared, his eyes swept the room in a hard, predatory gaze. Looking to his right and left, he marched toward my table and put out his hand. I stood up, and we shook hands perfunctorily.
"Your wounds are healing well," the general said.
"I'm feeling much better, thank you," I replied.
"You're taking me to see my son, is that understood?" the general said.
"No, that's not understood at all," I said. "I'm going to take you on a walk through Rome. Jordan'll decide if he'll see you or not."
"But he knows I want to see all this resolved in his favor," the general said. "He must know that I wouldn't have come all this way if I didn't still love him."
"First he wants to see if anyone's followed you," I said.
"That sounds a bit like paranoia to me," the general said.
"General," I asked, "don't you think paranoia's appropriate in this instance?"
"I would never do anything to hurt my son," the general said.
"You already have," I answered. "We'll know if you want to reverse that by the end of the day."
"What do you mean by that?" the general snapped.
"We'll see how it plays out."
The two of us left the Raphael and proceeded to walk to the Santa Maria della Pace, where we approached a side door on which I knocked loudly 3 times. 3 knocks were heard in reply, the door swung open, and I led the general through the doorway beneath the semicircular porch and into the interior, where we passed the grateful sibyls of Raphael himself, as we made our way toward a beautiful marble altar and out through a sacristy door that led to the cloisters, where shy nuns watched our passage without comment or interest. Another portiere awaited us with an open door, and I passed along 10,000 lira for the services of both men. We were now loose in the alleyways of Rome, the secret part of the city that I loved best. It was like walking through fields of rust and burnt sienna in this many-warrened section of Rome, with its deep, one-roomed shops, whose proprietors sat behind antique desks, patient as stalagmites. I could not restrain myself from pointing out shops of historical or architectural merit as we wound through the streets that cut off suddenly from the Via dei Coronari. Twice, we doubled back on ourselves, then took a cab at a taxi stand near the Corso Vittorio Emanuele.
I ordered the driver to take us to the Pincio, near the Borghese Gardens.
"This is amateur hour, Jack," the general said. "I worked for Navy Intelligence for 2 years, and you can't shake a good tail just by playing tag."
"Oh, we are just amateurs, General," I said. "Please bear with us."
"Who's making sure we're not being followed?" the general asked.
"Jordan," I answered.
"We passed by him?"
"Twice," I said. "Have you liked Rome?"
"I haven't. Too chaotic. The city has no sense of order," the general said.
I disagreed and said, "It has a perfect sense of order, but it's a Roman sense of order and not necessarily understood by outsiders." We were dropped off at the Pincio, and I led the general along its promenade, which overlooks all of Rome. From there, everything looked different. From the height and the angle of the walkway were revealed thousands of scrupulously kept terraces hidden on the rooftops of the city. We walked on until we came to the Spanish Steps, which we went down, with me holding on to the general's arm for balance. It was as hard and sinewy as a young wrestler's, and I could not help but notice what a fine figure of a man he was, and I well understood how a young soldier could follow such a detached, unreachable man into battle. If he had any soft places, they were well hidden. The general grew impatient with the game playing, and I was beginning to grow exhausted and irritable. But by the time we reached Dal Bolognese on the Piazza del Popolo, I was positive we were not being followed. However, the coiled intensity of the general alarmed me. He clearly had no capacity for lightheartedness or small talk, and nothing about Rome seemed to interest him. We entered the Bar Rosati, and I paid the cashier for 2 cappuccini. Though the general looked agitated, he saw he had no choice but to continue his participation in this long, enervating diversion. The bar was filling up with businessmen who needed their aperitivi before wandering out to their favorite restaurants for lunch. The general watched me closely as we both heard the sound of a helicopter overhead, but he kept his equanimity and his demeanor calm. There was little to be said between us that would not open old wounds, and the silence was wearing on me. Under normal circumstances, the general did not mind spending time with people he knew disliked him. It made the other person extremely self-conscious and prone to error, and he tried to use this to his own advantage.
"What's the next step?" the general asked.
"I don't know," I answered, looking out toward the Piazza del Popolo. "We must be patient."
"I've been patient, and all we've done is go around in circles."
Then I saw Ladere walking in swift steps out of the Via del Babuino toward the monumental gate, Porta del Popolo. She did not look in our direction as the general studied her well-rehearsed promenade across the length of the piazza. A blue Volvo station wagon came through the Porta del Popolo and drove toward Ladere, stopping beside her. 4 men, all Franciscan priests, emerged from the car, and each began to move off in different directions from the obelisk in the center. One of the priests stopped, and Ladere kissed him lightly on the cheek and pointed to the place where I was with the general.
"Where's his beard?" the general said.
"Shaved it after he was on television," I answered. "You saw that in the photographs."
"He's heavier," the general said.
The priest walked toward us with the sun behind him, a diffident, disinterested walk that lacked all resolution.
"Is it him?" the general said. "It's been so long, and the sun's in my eyes. I can't tell if it's really him or not."
"Do you want to be alone with him?" I asked.
"Not yet," the general said. "Please stay, at least until we get the matter of introductions over with."
"You don't need any introduction," I said. "It's your son." As the priest approached us, he pulled back his cowl, revealing a head of thick, dark curls. The general reached out to shake hands with his son, and there was a sudden movement in the bar behind us as 3 men burst out of the interior of Dal Bolognese. The general held his son's hand fiercely as an undercover agent from Interpol expertly placed handcuffs on the priest. Every entrance into the Piazza del Popolo was suddenly blocked by blue Fiats with their swirling azure lights and their irritating sirens.
"I told you it was amateur hour, Jack," the general said. "They fitted me with a device. They followed us every step of the way."
"Jordan wanted me to give you a message if it turned out this way, General," I said, watching as 2 agents roughly dragged Ladere toward us.
He made it simple. You didn't surprise him at all.
Let him deliver the message himself, the general said, staring at his son.
Now will you tell me my part in this silly charade, Jack, me boy?
The priest said to me, in an Irish accent so thick that even the Italian policeman knew this was no American. He also removed a pair of dark sunglasses.
"Where's my son, Jordan Elliot?" the general demanded of the Irish priest.
"I don't know what you're talking about,"
the priest said affably, enjoying the excitement and the crowd that had gathered around them. For hours they questioned me at Interpol's headquarters about my relationship with Jordan Elliot, and I answered all their questions forthrightly. I could tell them nothing about this priest's daily existence in Rome. I had no idea what order Jordan belonged to, or where he slept at night, or where he celebrated Mass. But I gladly provided a list of churches in which we had passed letters to each other, and I offered the detail that he wore the habits of several different orders. Celestine Elliot also underwent a grueling interrogation about her knowledge of her son's underground activities, but Jordan had protected her with the same shroud of ignorance he had me. Celestine answered her interrogators with a blind, unclassifiable fury, but offered no information not required by the questions. Ladair was released after being questioned for less than an hour. She was a minor player by her own admission, had not seen Jordan since she was in college, and only talked to someone claiming to be Jordan through a confessional screen. When released, she went back to my apartment on the Piazza Farnese and, with the help of Maria, began to pack Leah's bags for a long stay in America. Jordan later reported to me that while his father stood in the Piazza del Popolo watching the Irish Franciscan coming toward him, Jordan himself stood on a terrace above the Red Lion bookshop, observing his father's exercise in bad faith unfold. Treachery and misunderstanding had been the only constants in their lives together. He could forgive his father for venality, but not for treachery, not again. Jordan had stayed long enough to see his father's confusion the moment he realized that his trap had been avoided and he had fallen prey, instead, to one set for him. But there was such anguish on his father's face that Jordan had felt for a moment a dormant pity. Jordan had watched as his father spun in a circle, looking at doorways and rooftops and the ramparts of the Borghese Gardens, knowing that Jordan was watching him and realizing that he had been outmaneuvered and outsoldiered by a son who had never led men into battle. By this action, the general also knew he had driven a stake through the heart of his marriage. That night after I was released and was back home, I stood at the far window looking out toward the bell tower of St. Thomas of Canterbury and saw only blackness. Ladair and I had gone over the events of the past day. Since the scene in the Piazza del Popolo, neither of us had heard from Jordan, Celestine, or the general. That evening, when she went to bed, I told Leah the whole story of my friendship with Jordan Elliot. All life connects, I told Leah. Nothing happens that is meaningless. After turning out Leah's light, I returned to the living room and poured both Ladair and myself a glass of Gavi de Igavi, which I had chilled in a bucket of ice. We toasted each other half-heartedly and drank in silence before Ladair said, "How are you feeling, Jack? You're still recovering and must be exhausted." I put my hand to my head and then to my chest. "In all the excitement, I forgot that I was hurt," I said.
"Has your eye cleared up?" she asked. "Is it still blurry?"
I put my hand over my right eye and stared at her with my left, then said, "The guy in the projection room still needs to adjust the knob, but just a little bit. It's getting better."
"I called Mike and told him that the general had issued the warning to Interpol," Ladair said. "He was relieved. I think he suspected that Capers might have done it."
"The project limps on," I said.
"Mike liked this part," she said. "He liked the general betraying the son a second time. He said it was biblical."
I said, "It's scary. Nothing bad can happen to any of us that won't be great for Mike's film."
I looked up at the window, saw something, then rushed into the vestibule of the front hall, flicked on the light, and stood framed in the window that had the apartment's only view of St. Peter's. Someone was sending signals from the bell tower, but if it was Jordan, it was an hour after our appointed time. Whoever was handling the flashlight was an amateur at Morse code, and it took 3 times before I could decipher any message at all. "Jordan is safe," the first message said. "God bless you," said the second.
"Where do you think Jordan is tonight?" Ladere asked.
"I don't know, Ladere. I've never known."
"How will he get back in touch with you?"
I was about to answer when I saw a figure making its way across the piazza and heading straight for my apartment. "Jesus Christ," I said. "Tell me my shot-out eyes deceiving me." Down below, General Elliot was moving toward my building as though he were being reeled in by a line. "Do you have a rifle?" Ladere said. "The kindest thing to do would be to shoot him before he reached the door." The buzzer sounded its ugly raspberry cheer, and Ladere kissed me on the cheek and said good night. She had endured all the psychodrama of which she was capable in a 24-hour period. I walked to the speakerphone in an unlit hallway and then picked up the receiver. "Chia?" I asked.
"Jack," the general said. "It's me, General Elliot.